Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Litecoin Underground podcast. This week we had something that came off a live stream we did. We've been doing these on Saturday mornings. If you aren't checking us out on YouTube or Twitter, we're doing video live interviews of people kind of from all parts of the crypto world, and maybe even trying to step outside that a little bit. So this week we had in Vlad Kostya. He has, been what I hope is the first of many of what I would call Bitcoiners, Bitcoin maximalists, Bitcoin only people who have started to soften on the idea of using some altcoins. I think that it was the norm probably back in 2015, 16, 17. And it's good to see that he's kind of coming around to the idea that, look, if you look at the reality of the world, people are using Litecoin in higher and higher quantities, and I think you will hear him say towards the end of this episode, something's kind of broken in the process of developing on Bitcoin. And so I think he's wanting to ruffle some feathers. I think some of the reason he's being a detractor or kind of a counterculturist of sorts inside of Bitcoin is because he wants to see change. He wants to see the continued push for privacy, self-custody, those types of things that we always talk about. And he recognizes like Litecoin's making those moves. And so I'm glad to engage with the Litecoin community, but he did a Litecoin magazine. I would say go to his, follow him. He's the TheVladCostea, the Vlad Kostya. And, I think he might be the real Vlad Kostya. I think I already messed that up. But you can find him if you look for him and on Twitter. And I think you can order some of the magazine we talk about a little bit. But overall, we got to meet Vlad at the summit. He's a good dude. And I think it's really exciting to have him on board and be so, so vocal about his support for Litecoin. So his podcast is the Bitcoin Takeover Podcast, Bitcoin TKV. I think it's BTC TKVR. I feel like this has been a linguistic test or something today. So, all right, I'll let you get to it. But as always, I appreciate the support. Every week you guys are, the subscriptions are growing on YouTube now that we're back and making some content, have an animal in. I'm actually recording this right now, this intro on the 13th birthday of Litecoin. So I've been doing this for 3 years and I really appreciate the support throughout it. But what I've really appreciated over the last 2+ years has been Cake Wallet, our sponsor, the official wallet of the Litecoin Underground. You know, I talk about them every week. We probably mention them on almost every episode just because they really do all the things that you'd be looking for in a self-custody wallet. So it's your keys, your coins. No one can control them. You can open as many Litecoin wallets and Monero wallets and Bitcoin wallets as you want. You can swap between assets. You can buy inside the app. You can go buy gift cards. I just used it at Sonic to buy something for my, we got a family night at Sonic. Great, bought a gift card. So it's a really easy way to use your Litecoin. And, you know, you get the new MWeb launch just happened today here on October 13th. It's live out there. So go check it out, download it, and as always, enjoy the show. All right. Hey, everybody. We're going to try this going live today on YouTube and Twitter. I hope this works out well. We're going to have in here, you can see Vlad Kostya, host of the Bitcoin Takeover. Yeah, look, I got mine too. I got mine.
Oh.
my co-host Animal in here again today. So we're going to try this out. Hopefully it works. If you can, I think, comment, you can come on to YouTube. I'm not sure if the Twitter comments work. Vlad does these more than I do. 22. Is that a donation? Is that a donation QR code?
No, it's where you can actually download the magazine for free. It's bitcoin-takeover.com/Litecoin, and you can read this for free. So you don't have to. I mean, you can print it yourself. It's an open source project. That's the beauty of it. But I want people to read this because, of course, I'm being selfish and self-absorbed and whatever. But I think it's pretty good content to onboard people to Litecoin and explain why it's a useful open source money project.
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of get into how this came to be. Actually, here's the page where you have to donate. If anybody wants to donate for Vlad's magazine, for making this magazine, you can use that QR code, pause it and scan it. I do want to get into kind of how you came to be a, I don't even know what you call yourself anymore, whether you even want to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. I'm the ultimate Bitcoin maximalist.
Okay.
Because I'm looking at technology, not from a dogmatic point of view, but more from a point of view where I search for stuff that can improve Bitcoin.
Right.
So that's what people don't understand. They think, oh, I'm being trolly. I'm being this horrible shitcoiner who's getting paid by whatever conspiracy theory they make up. But at the end of the day, I try to improve this project, which I love. And for that, I sort of lost faith in the people who LARP all day and they say, oh, Bitcoin only, pay me to build this, and then they ship nothing. And of course, the free market is much better at building stuff as opposed to just click of developers and conference attendees who like to talk big words about what Bitcoin is and what it does. But then years pass and you realize that nothing's really getting built. And you realize that Lightning has been a bitter disappointment. And you realize that not much of what was promised was actually delivered. We were supposed to have sidechains. We were supposed to have much better on-chain privacy. I remember at one point there was this hype about pay-to-endpoint that was supposed to be this technology that ends blockchain analysis, which goes back all the way to pay-to-IP, which was the first way to actually make Bitcoin payments. And also, I remember when Taproot was being advertised as this improvement that's going to destroy blockchain analysis because transactions are going to be indistinguishable from one another. And so far, it only works for a certain type of multisigs, which barely have wallet support. So it's just that there's this culture of complacency, and I guess people are drunk in their number go up stasis. And they need to wake up. And there are other open source projects which are doing all the good work. And they're proving how stuff is supposed to work and that it's safe and that it has market demand. And sometimes when you really like a girl and you're chasing her and she's not paying attention to you, it's good to go after her friend. You know how it works?
Oh, yeah.
You go after her friend and then she will think about you all the time.
I've been thinking that about you because you've been very, I would say, purposely harping on the privacy thing. And I felt like reading your stuff, you're not doing it because you're like genuinely saying, hey, I'm going to abandon Bitcoin. You're trying to prove a point that these chains are functioning and they're adding these layers of privacy, and it's a benefit and it's not harmful. I think that's what you're trying to point out. Like, look, guys, this is out there, and if this stuff gains monetarily versus Bitcoin, then what's, you need to explain to me, you need to resell me on Bitcoin, I guess is what you're, I think what you're trying to do, you're trying to trigger kind of a, at least look into this stuff, make people dive into it a little more deeply.
Well, I think we have this church of toxic maximalism, which is making people regard Bitcoin from the wrong perspective. At the end of the day, it's software, right? It's just computer code that people run under computers, and then they agree that certain transactions are valuable and others are not. I can agree with this. It's all an MMORPG where we're trading World of Warcraft gold, but without Blizzard in the middle. I do get that. But you have to understand that forking and running alternative clients is part of open source software. You have all sorts of flavors of Linux. And the fact that one exists and tries something which maybe is not part of the official kernel, whatever that means, is a net benefit because it's testing features which become valuable. And sometimes you find stubborn people who say, we don't need this and we don't want to add this because it's going to end up to these consequences. And that's how you legitimize the forks. So you can't really have it both ways. You can't say that Bitcoin shouldn't change because the number doesn't go up and the bankers stop buying, while also saying that forks of Bitcoin are shitcoins because they obviously deliver certain use cases which you don't have or which you no longer endorse or support or have been priced out.
The primary argument they would say is that those chains have accrued some value, but it's purely in the playing some kind of tokenomics, and the end game is to for them to just buy back into Bitcoin anyway. There's not real utility there. It's all just smoke and mirrors. Is that kind of the pushback you get?
Well, it's not that nuanced, but people say, oh, of course, these shitcoiners are spending their coins when they get the chance because the plan is to exit, you know? They don't have any conviction to hold it. And that's why the number doesn't go up. But there is more to this. And of course, you can go into conspiracy theories and look into exchanges and how volumes, how a lot of money goes into these altcoins, but at the same time, they're suppressed from getting pumped as heavily as Bitcoin. Of course, you can make theories about institutions not actually buying some of these altcoins. But honestly, there are users. And I think at the end of the day, it's not about the price. It's about the number of users that you can onboard. And Solana was the joke of the entire industry for a while. They were making fun of it. It was in bed with FTX and SBF and all of these people we don't hear about much anymore. But they're able to bounce back and they're able to become a threat to Ethereum. And everyone was making fun of them. They had shutdowns. They were going to Discord to find consensus and whatever. But they kept building. And it's centralized, yes. It's not the best implementation of what it can be. But at the end of the day, they have the users. And that's why they're dangerous right now for Ethereum. They're eating their cake. And Ethereum people just watch and they hope that they're going to fix it with rollups. And they're the technocrats right now. They're the ones that are trying to play conservative, while this alternative to Ethereum is actually getting more users because of meme coins and because they're not afraid to make some compromises. And to me, it's interesting that this is happening. It's the sort of situation that never happened in Bitcoin with big blocks. You had the big block hard fork, which never took off, mainly, I think, because of Craig Wright and because of some scandals that were associated with it. It never really had a chance because it was so politically compromised and it was destined to fork constantly and have conflicts and infighting, which BTC did not have. But I'm sure that if this hard fork had a much better history, it could actually pose a real threat to Bitcoin. And right now, Litecoin is, I guess, what BCH was supposed to be in terms of adoption and in
Charlie,
terms of Charlie's market recognition.
Charlie's the first big blocker.
No, he's not. Dude, there's Jeff Garzik. You can go back.
I'm saying, he's the one that went out and made a chain that had four times the block space. You know what I mean? He said, this is too slow.
I don't think he was the first one to do it, but he's the most successful one, yes.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well,
do you
go ahead.
Yeah, do you think that the maximalists would be so toxic if the big blockchain hadn't been created, if Bitcoin Cash didn't exist? Because I have a theory that they're, you know, they've painted themselves into a corner with their position. And now they've got to stick to their guns. Otherwise, they'll just prove that Bitcoin Cash is superior.
No, so there is some legitimacy to that because at one point, you know, it was a very ugly civil war, at least socially, because there were these accounts like the RBTC Reddit thread that turned out to be supportive of BCH. And there was the @Bitcoin account on Twitter, which was supporting BCH. And there was Bitcoin.com, which was recommending people to buy BCH. So there was this response to the fact that they were trying to hijack the brand. They were trying to pretend that they're the real Bitcoin. And I think that's where it failed. Because if it pretended to be its own thing and said, okay, BTC doesn't want to do this, we're going to do it and prove to them that they were wrong about the market, they could have absorbed that market. But it seems like the users who are trying to be vengeful, or the companies that were trying to build on Bitcoin in 2016, 2017, and they gave up, they went to Ethereum. And that one ended up getting a lot of revenge traction. It wasn't BCH, it wasn't Litecoin, it was Ethereum that
yeah.
somehow became popular. Even if it's not ideal, it's not the best of chains, it wasn't perfect, but it was there at the right time.
Yeah, it was almost like the people that wanted to do all these creative things that required the block space, they went to the place that had the most heat, or whatever you want to call it, right? The most ability to expand with an audience and their ability to be creative. So they just didn't, they felt, I guess, restricted obviously by 1 megabyte blocks. So do you, can we back up? Cause actually Animal wanted to ask you this. I'm going to steal Animal's question. I kind of want to go back and ask you about, you know, we met at the Litecoin Summit and, it was your first trip to America from my understanding.
Oh yeah. North America, because I've been to Argentina last year.
When we say America in America, you know we mean America, USA. You're aware of this, right? You're aware that this is how we how
I'm
we
aware of the
world.
James Brown song.
Yeah, living in America. Okay. What were your impressions? Because you had barbecue for the first time. I think you went to that fight. That Nick,
it was not
Carter
my first
fight.
Barbecue. It was maybe my first
American
turned brisket.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Beef brisket. I think you went to. I don't know where you went. All in all, I think we had you at that fast food place, right? Is that where you?
Yeah. We.
Oh, we
yeah. Yeah. It was Kales or something.
Canes, Raising Canes.
Canes,
Raising Canes.
So, like overall, what were your first impressions of the U.S.? And like, did anything jump out at you like that surprised you? Was there anything that you were just like, wow, either the people were different than I thought, or like the landscape, or maybe it was like signs everywhere blew you away? What was it?
You have to understand that when you live in Eastern Europe and you used to be in a communist country that was trying to establish some good relations with the US, then you grew up with American television and American films, and I had old Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone and Dolph Lundgren and Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal. I watched all of that crap when I was a child, basically.
Right.
So to me, it wasn't a culture shock in the way that people were behaving. I spent my teenage years learning about American culture, but what really surprised me was the size of the cars. Like, you guys are driving fucking tanks.
There are some. The trucks have gotten just out of control, man. We're like, it's
I called an Uber
like
when
your
I
shoulder
got
is at the front
airport.
Of the hood, you know.
I called an Uber and it was a Jeep Grand Cherokee, and I was thinking, why is this necessary for one person?
Oh, Cherokee, just so you know.
Cherokee. Cherokee. Okay,
Cherokee.
Fine.
Yeah.
Cherokee.
I mean, Jeeps are good in the winter, I'll tell you that. You need a four-wheel drive. I mean, when the snow, like at least in Canada, I'm not sure about Nashville. I think Nashville is more just a cowboy thing. But yeah, we got big roads here and a lot of like, we need to drive everywhere, right? Like in the province I live in, you know, we had friends that want to go see the whales and stuff. So we went and took him to this place called Tadoussac. It's within Quebec. And you know what? We drove for like 6 or 7 hours to get there. 6 or 7 hours in one direction, and we're still in the same province, right? Whereas in Europe and Romania, you're driving like, you know, I don't know how long does it take you to get from one to the other in Romania? Like 3 hours tops? Not even.
No, it's a large country and we don't have great roads. Yeah.
Okay.
So you can even drive 10 hours if you want to get to the other side.
Oh, really?
Like diametrically opposed points. Because you have to cross mountains. It's not very leveled. I don't know how I should describe it. It's not just a plane.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But we have pretty small cars. The sedans are king here. I do see SUVs becoming popular, but SUVs are very tiny in Nashville.
Compared to the trucks and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder how much... Everything in our culture is big. Like, even if you go buy a couch or something, it's like you can't even fit them in your living room anymore. You're like, well, I don't understand this. What, it's not more comfortable, it's just bigger, you know. But anyway, so how did you get into crypto, and like, what did you do before you found Bitcoin, so to speak?
I was a PhD student who wanted to write his thesis about internet privacy, which is a very interesting fact, because I watched the Snowden revelations. And before that, I was able to get 100,000 signatures against something that was called ACTA. This was back in 2011, early 2012.
100,000 signatures?
Yeah, from Romanians.
Dang.
And I didn't use that later. So as soon as that cause ended, and I think that was at the peak of clicktivism, as soon as that cause ended, I never used it again. I didn't open that account. I didn't send another message to the group. I was like, okay, this reached its goal. I'm done with it. I didn't use it for political purposes, for promoting Bitcoin, for anything else. I just forgot about it, because it's my way of being honest. It was created for a purpose. I could communicate with a lot of people for that purpose. But at the time, there was this initiative, which was called ACTA, and it had some equivalents in the US called SOPA or PIPA, P-I-P-A. And it was a way to end piracy and try to impose very strict regulations against distribution of digital files, and also patents, trying to enforce them in ways that even generic medicines were excluded from the market. So basically something like aspirin could only be made by the original company. No other forks, to call it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I created a petition back in 2011. I think it was January of 2012, actually. And it had that snowball effect. And all of a sudden, I was this minor celebrity in the internet space with this crazy kid who was willing to admit that he pirated all of his software when he was growing up, and could defend it by saying it was super educational. I could never get my hands on something like Windows XP, you know, legally. It was too expensive for my parents to afford. But I could use it and I could learn. And right now I have a pretty decent job because of the fact that I could access that. So for my country, it was super beneficial.
So and are you like, are you well known in Romania?
No.
Or were you at some point?
I think I was a minor internet celebrity for a while. I did a couple of interviews. I went to a protest, which happened to be on my 20th birthday. And what? I was super active in this field until I think the next summer it fell through, because it was supposed to be voted in the European Commission or something. And there was too much resistance from citizens and people, you know, politicians like to get elected. Mm-hmm. So they realized it's unpopular, so they gave up on it. But it was a big deal at the time, and I decided I want to write my thesis, my bachelor thesis, about something concerning the internet. And then in 2013, there was the wave of revelations coming from Edward Snowden. To me, it was the perfect storm. I watched that and I said to myself, I want to write about internet privacy. And I went to my supervisor and I told him this, and he said, you know, you're in the political science department. It's very hard for you to get aligned with what you're learning right now. We deal with elections. We deal with stuff like this. So why don't you write about online elections, which was pretty interesting, honestly. I did my research about this. I wrote a pretty decent thesis about it. And then I wanted to do something about internet privacy for my master's, but I ended up doing something about internet governance, which was a comparison of different countries and how they deal with the internet, whether or not they have censorship and stuff like this. So in a sense, it was still related, but not directly internet privacy. And then I got into Bitcoin during my PhD, and I dropped out from my PhD to focus more on Bitcoin stuff. And here I am, I guess. Like 7 or 8 years later, I'm still trying to advocate for improving Bitcoin after 6 years almost of doing my podcast and doing interviews. I'm at this point where I'm fighting with the culture which brought me and orange pilled me and whatever.
Was it,
I'd always thought you were like, I always thought you would have done something in computer science, because you're honestly probably the most technical Bitcoin, or one of the most technical Bitcoin podcasters, right?
Like, well, in high school, I did C++ coding. I wasn't very good at it, which is why I didn't pursue it in university. But if you give me a basic sequence of code, I can understand some parts of it and figure out what it does. But now with ChatGPT, you can be lazy. You can just paste it into it and ask. So I haven't refined my skill.
It's funny. Yeah. And if we have time, I kind of want to circle back to the patent thing, because I just had an online little spat with somebody about patents and this libertarian idea that patents are, you know, a state sponsored monopoly, I guess, on an idea, and that they're ultimately detrimental to success. And I look at the world and say, since patents have existed, it's been better. But this might be an example of where maybe that's not the case. But I want to shelf that. I don't want to talk about that. If we have time at the end, we'll talk a bit about patents. But going back to your, I guess what you just said, your spat, and what you kind of started off with, you know, I think you've come into our spaces maybe even like up to a year ago. I was familiar with your show. I think you were familiar, you're aware of us. But you really, gained more prominence, or you were the lightning rod of activity on Bitcoin Twitter back in March when you dared to platform Roger Ver, the author of Hijacking Bitcoin. If you don't know who Roger Ver is, you probably just have to go find out who Roger Ver is. he was for me, when I first got into Bitcoin, a guy that I think gave that great inspirational message to what Bitcoin was intended to do. And definitely got me down the rabbit hole of like understanding how this money, how the system works today with the creation of money and the fiat system, at least sparked my curiosity and got me realizing, oh, this is something I'd never thought about. At the point I was, 30, in my late 30s, mid to late 30s, when I first, it took me that long to ever even think about it, you know, and I was never somebody that was not intellectual. I just hadn't even questioned that before. So he wrote a book about kind of the block size wars and his experiences from it. I didn't read the book, so I know I should, but that it essentially laid bare that there was a lot of censorship, a lot of, deplatforming, but I guess silencing, right, of shouting down of big block voices. And then ironically, you interview him, and that's the same tactic that gets used against you. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like people were trying to essentially shut down your opinion?
Oh, there was a Streisand effect, I think, for a while, because people were curious to check it out. But I don't think most of them got past the first 10 minutes. And I do have this tendency to look back and see what people were doing before I got into Bitcoin. I do have a lot of respect for people like Eric Voorhees and Roger Ver, and Jeff Garzik was the developer who actually coded the SegWit2x fork. He was one of the first people to get into Bitcoin, and also the first big blocker. Back in 2010, he proposed to Satoshi a version of Bitcoin that had 6 or 7 megabyte blocks. And Satoshi said, don't run this code because it's going to be out of consensus, and it's a good idea to be on the same network. It's too early for this. But that was the first time someone proposed a block size increase. Indirectly, he was just messing with the code and said, what if we run this? So I do have a lot of respect for these guys. They laid the foundation. I've also had Charlie Schrem on my show last week. Mm-hmm. And that's also a big deal. That guy was the first Bitcoin martyr, the first guy to go to jail because of Bitcoin. And it was because he ran an exchange called BitInstant, and he sold some coins to someone who was going to spend them on the Silk Road. And he knew about that. He didn't care about that. But it seems like the U.S. government disagreed with his idea that money is fungible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting that there are some guys who laid the foundations of everything, and they created the narratives that people take for granted now about Bitcoin being like digital gold and whatever. but they don't get any recognition from the new generation. It seems like there's this tendency to rewrite history and create these heroes who are going to get destroyed and slain along the process and replaced by others, but in a way that does not recognize the merits. If you really want to know what's happening, you have to go back in history and talk to some of these people who have been disgraced. And to me, that's nasty, because you couldn't get Bitcoin to the same point if it wasn't for Roger. He sold his Lambo to buy more Bitcoin back in 2011. He was that kind of guy. He wasn't the kind of guy who bought a Lambo with his Bitcoin gains. And he was also the first one to finance projects like Zcash and companies like blockchain.com. So back in the day when everyone was not sure if Bitcoin is going to be useful, or they were reluctant to finance startups and Bitcoin, he was actually giving money to a lot of them. So from this point of view, he deserves recognition and respect. It's just that maybe he let his ego go too far in 2017, and he believed that what he was running was much bigger than the open source project Bitcoin. Maybe that he was impatient with the block size increase and did not believe in SegWit. But he did join the big block camp. He did get lied to by Craig Wright. He was deceived. He actually sued him and won in court before any of the HODL Knot or Peter McCormack cases. But he never really got that redemption story. So it seems like he was labeled in a certain way. And no matter what he did afterwards, he was just that guy, you know? He was a villain, no matter what he did afterwards. And I think people like Andreas Antonopoulos got some of the same treatment, and it's even worse in the case of Andreas. And people were already angry at him because he did not pick sides during the block size wars. And then he co-wrote a book that's called Mastering Ethereum. And that was enough for a bunch of events and a bunch of old friends of his to basically cancel him.
No way. I was going to ask, like, what happened to Andreas? Because he was, you know, prior to the block size wars, he was, I think, my primary resource, right? There was another guy, Joe D'Agostino, who's really good. I think the Bitcoin Blackboard series he made. But Andreas Antonopoulos, he had a way of explaining it that was just second to none.
And it made well, for a lot of people, he was the Michael Saylor, you know,
the
guy who was telling you Bitcoin is indestructible. Bitcoin is going to get a lot of adoption because you have these Gen Z people who have no money, but they have skills and they're willing to put into it. He was also talking about kids creating their own coin and having this libertarian experiment, which at the time was popular, but the culture changed. And I think that's the issue, right? Because he was consistent in his beliefs. He came from this open source background, and then he did not adapt with the culture. He never became this toxic maximalist. So they ate him alive and they replaced him, because that's what they do. There are only maybe a few slots for keynote speeches at conferences. And he was basically one of the headliners wherever he was going. So a bunch of guys made sure that he doesn't get invited anymore.
That's ridiculous. Because he was always like, he was always the voice of reason, right? And I'm guessing that's why, because a lot of the arguments that the Maxis make kind of are not, or they lack some kind of integrity, right? It's like,
I guess he also lost some of his passion, and he doesn't care as much. I met him last year. He was very chill.
Yeah.
He called himself retired from Bitcoin.
That's the other thing, right? So at some point, these OGs, you know, they have Bitcoin themselves, and at some point they're like, why stick my neck out, right? Like, what do I have to gain from this? The project's succeeded as far as I'm concerned, mostly, and I don't need the trouble anymore, right?
There's a little bit, you know, you mentioned early adopters and like Roger selling a Lambo to acquire more Bitcoin, like. That mentality has obviously led to success of Bitcoin, the HODL, this convicted buyers, right? People not convicted, like going to jail, but like having conviction, is important early on. Like, I think the monetary value is it matters, right? It gets eyeballs. It grows the awareness. Yeah, it grows awareness, grows adoption, whether you want to call it buyers. And that's an important aspect. And it's a matter of when does it have to turn into not speculating anymore? And I think that's what hopefully is going to happen at some point, is that there's a recognition that you can't just live on this model forever.
No, of course not. I mean, think about the world economy, right? If you actually don't live in your mom's basement and you are actually part of the economy and you go out every day and you buy stuff and you understand the importance of taking loans and taking risk and credit and all of these elements of the financial system, you understand that there's no way a huddling economy can work.
Right.
What's going to happen? You're going to negotiate which user is going to give up on his HODL stash to fix the roads or something?
Well, in what obviously, and what is happening, and what I think you're recognizing, and the statistics show, is that people are just picking a different route. They're like, you know, this just doesn't, if I am going to use it, this doesn't work for me. Bitcoin doesn't work for me anymore. And so they're just going around and using something else, whether it's stable coins or Solana or Litecoin. That's the worst part of it, is that we've reached an upper limit of users and people are never even engaging. People are in crypto and they never engage with Bitcoin now. They've just taken themselves away as an option. And that's got to be the worst case scenario, is that you just get left behind.
Well, that's definitely a scenario that can happen. You get a lot of these. I think it started with the ICO mania, but even at the time, people were converting their Ethereum to Bitcoin. But after the NFT mania, I think Ethereum became, I think it was perceived as much more valuable than before. And then you mm-hmm. also had a much higher or much easier access to stable coins. And I do think that stable coins are truly shameful for the entire industry. I mean, for the free market, people wanted to build a currency that is outside of the US dollar system. The fact that USDT is so big and everyone wants to receive USDT is a shame. It just proves that all the evangelists and everyone who was trying to promote Bitcoin or Litecoin or something else has failed to a degree, because people want that.
It's pretty ironic. Yeah, when you consider that the project that was meant to dethrone US dollar hegemony has actually enabled it.
Well, I don't know.
The first instance of USDT was built on Bitcoin.
I feel like
there was the OmniLayer for that.
I feel like it's a natural step. Right? They're the users of these things are appreciating the utility of cross-border payments, uncensored transactions, right? And the ability to choose which money they want to use. Now, just because they haven't chosen what we consider to be, you know, better money, sound money, I don't think that's a loss. I really see this as step one, and that people are getting comfortable with the technology. And until they feel that the dollar is not giving them what they need, then they should use the money that they see as best fit for them. Like they don't want the volatility. They just want low fees and cross-border payments, and that's it. So in a libertarian ideal, they're choosing the thing that checks the boxes for them, right? They as customers are getting the most benefit, because HODLing doesn't make sense for people who don't have any money.
Well, I do get that savings is a luxury. But at the same time, Tether can be censored, and they do have a list of blacklisted addresses, and they do have limits in certain countries where they can only transact certain amounts in one day or one month or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not what you think it is. It's not like Litecoin or Bitcoin, where you send as much as you want to anyone and there is a censorship resistance mechanism that's going to assure both parties involved in the transaction that there's finality for it.
In but don't Tether, you feel like that's the next step? Like people have to experience that. They have to go, oh, dude, my Tether got shut down, or I was only allowed to send X amount, or these fees. Like, I guess fees on Tron have gotten so high now. Like, they'll start looking for alternatives, and at least they're comfortable with the way these things work now. Where pre-stablecoin, they weren't even engaging with blockchains at all.
Well, in the US, you have services like Venmo and Cash App and whatever, which I think work much better in terms of user experience than Tether. Tether is for underdeveloped countries and people who actually live in very inflationary environments. And I think Tether has also been very convenient for the US government that's trying to export inflation towards other nations. The fact that you have low inflation these days, compared to the expectation at least, is due to the fact that you successfully exported your inflation to other territories.
Yeah. Colonizing Web 3.0. Right?
So it's a shame from my point of view. And also, coming back to toxic Bitcoin maximalism, you have to look at their predictions, right? They say everything is going to zero against Bitcoin. They say, oh, look, the world economy is going to collapse during the pandemic. Oh, this money printing of trillions of dollars is going to spike prices proportionately. It just proves that they're clueless about how the world works and how the dynamics of supply and demand are functioning. And they're making these predictions even about silly stuff like the stock-to-flow price model. And they double down on it. And then you see how wrong they can be. And then you look at their predictions about stuff like Ethereum 2.0 never coming out and never becoming proof of stake. And that one actually happens. And then what's left of their predictions? And it's frustrating to watch this and realize that you're on this camp with people who are constantly making wrong predictions. And they don't seem smart. They just seem ideological. And that's pretty much it. It's more like a church than it is something scientific or a meritocracy.
Would you say they've lost some of their integrity?
It's very hard to define that because I'm not sure if they had it in the first place.
Fair enough.
You just have people who are ideological, dogmatic, or else getting paid to promote narratives. And I don't know where they started.
That's true. And I mean, especially newer Bitcoiners, they might believe it, right? So they might not, I don't want to say they might not know better because what do I know? But they might not have the context of, you know, the last 10 years, right? They just have.
I do think about this a lot because when I was in Nashville, I went to this party by Unchained Capital. And I just went there with a bunch of guys. And I looked around and I realized that I don't fit in, you know. Everyone there looked like a banker. They were talking about yield and whatever return they made on investments. And they were older than me, like in their mid-40s. And they just had that aesthetic. Like, I was thinking, what am I doing here?
You're finance.
I just got my free dinner and I left because I realized I'm in the wrong place. And the other extreme of the spectrum is that after this, I went to the Taproot Wizards party. And that one was just too edgy for me. It felt like I'm too old for that.
Yeah, even though Udi's like same guy is in the 45, mid 40s, you know, that's me. But you know what's funny? You make me think about, do you know the movie It's a Wonderful Life, the Christmas movie?
Yeah, I know it.
So, you know, George there's Bailey. A point, I've probably talked about this. Yeah, so George Bailey, when his uncle loses that money and he's desperate, and he goes to Old Man Potter, and Old Man Potter's like, you know what? You're a talented guy. You need to shut down that savings and loan. I'll pay you. Like, I think he offers him like six times or eight times what he's currently making, like to make more in a month, maybe more than that. Might've been some insane amount. And George Billy's like, you know, I don't need to talk to my wife. I'm done. Right. I'm frustrated with my business. And he doesn't want to go to jail. And he shakes Potter's hand. And he's just instantly like, no, I can't do it. Like, he gets this feeling comes over him, like just that this is slimy, right? He knows he's doing the wrong thing. And that's what makes me think of it when you say you go to this dinner and you're just like, these aren't my people. Like this is not the reason I'm interested in Bitcoin. This is not how the future of this is going to be successful. It's not just getting in bed with these people that clearly are winning the current system. They're just trying to exploit the system for monetary gain. There's no thought. And I've said this forever about like Saylor. I know Saylor's done some educational stuff, but the money he continues to pour into buying more Bitcoin as opposed to like finding ways to get it into the hands of more people. I mean, how many billions of dollars of Bitcoin does he need? Like at what point in time does it not, if it's going to $1 million or $10 million, then what's, I don't understand the purpose at this point. Right. So why not
world domination,
success of it? Why not promote the success of it as opposed to just acquiring more? Because that doesn't change anything for anyone.
Oh, it pumps the price. We went from 58K to 60K within a couple of hours of his announcement that he recently bought. And that's when I basically said what is super unpopular in Bitcoin, that right now the project has become proof of stake. And I can argue it because the most recent adventure of his was that he was responsible for denying a payment to Bitcoin Core developers from one of the ETFs, which was planning to give some of the profits to developers. And he was responsible directly for getting involved to stop that from happening. And if you go back to an interview that he did back in 2020 with BTC Times, he said, forget about cypherpunk principles. I actually have that on my phone, so I can read it so I don't misquote it.
Yeah, you just tweeted it this morning, I think, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be informative. I don't deal with speculation. I deal with facts. So he said, stop talking about regulatory arbitrage, censorship resistance, privacy, and tax evasion. They're bad ideas. We hate that. People with billions of dollars don't want to invest in crypto networks that support anarchists.
Wow.
So it's all you need to know, right? Because this was 4 years ago. And it seems like this year has been especially bad with cracking down on privacy services, shutting down the non-custodial Lightning wallets. It seems like only the custodial and compliant businesses in the space are allowed to function, to operate. And it's super disappointing. Not that this happened, but the reaction that followed it. There's just not enough resistance. It seems like Bitcoin is so culturally lost that people look at the price and they say, you know, this happened, but at the same time, last year we were at 30K and now we're at 60K. So, you know, everything is fine because the number is going up, but they fail to see how, I also called this yesterday the great replacement, right? You have this conspiracy theory in the West that we're going to get replaced by immigrants. And okay, in Bitcoin, I think there is something similar happening with the quote-unquote plebs, the people who are saying, oh, I'm here for the technology, for censorship resistance. I want to fight the government and I want to run my own node on Tor and be able to receive payments in spite of all of this censorship during the pandemic. They just give up and they get replaced by people who are much more friendly to bankers, and they go on conference stages and they complain that Bitcoin doesn't have enough regulations and institutions cannot adopt it. And the most funny thing I've seen, I think, came from the Polkadot, I don't know what to call them, project ecosystem or whatever. They mm-hmm. have this built-in voting system and mm-hmm. they stake their coins, and according to the size of their stake, they have a certain weight to their vote. And right. some proposal was made from Chainalysis, the company. And Chainalysis basically right now is the gatekeeper for institutional partnerships. So if there's any bank that wants to use, I guess, stable coins on their blockchain or build tokens to do whatever, then they have to go to Chainalysis and they have to green light the whole deal and say, you know, this chain is compliant, is working according to our rules or whatever. I don't mm-hmm. think they do much in terms of actual tooling. They just act as the big bully that extorts money. from users and says, if you want to get big, you have to pay us $6 million. And then we're going to allow you to have partnerships. And it's so funny. I think the first part of the vote was negative. They tried to reject the proposal and said that there's no substantial proof that this sort of deal is going to bring the users. But they, you know, in the proposal, Chainalysis actually said that they're going to bring in more adoption and more attention that potentially is going to make the price go up. So it's scary where this is heading. And that's why I double down on privacy. I think there was never a time in the history of the internet when privacy was so obviously necessary. Before this, I think privacy was for activists. It was for people who are trying to blatantly hide from the government for mm-hmm. whatever reason. But now there's a lot more tyranny. And morally speaking, you gotta hide from your government when it's tyrannical.
And right. You're in the right. Yeah. Yeah. The government's not, just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral, right?
I do see a lot of need for privacy right now. There was the Brazil situation with Twitter.
Yep.
There is this whole situation with blockchain analysis becoming more advanced. If you go back to read Satoshi's emails, he did say something about Bitcoin being able to buy cypherpunks a few years. He does say something along the lines of, this is going to be good enough for a few years until they catch up. Well, they caught up.
Mm. Yeah.
They have all the tools to track Bitcoin transactions and also Litecoin. I think Litecoin is much easier because there are fewer transactions. But with MWeb, at least you're taking a step in the right direction and you're doing something about it.
On top of privacy, I mean, another component to it is censorship, right? You know, Telegram, they were, at least what I heard, the reason why they did it was because he wasn't, he was protecting people, right? Protecting criminals and terrorists by not...
Allegedly, I don't know.
Allegedly. But if you ask me, I think that's bogus. That's a bogus reason because, you know, real criminals, organized crime, real terrorists, they're going to use Signal. They're going to use other tools that are more suited.
They're not going to use the internet.
Even. Yeah, sure. What I think the real cause between Pavel Durov's arrest was that he wasn't censoring messages coming out of Russia and Ukraine. They weren't able to control the narrative. They weren't able to control the propaganda. And people were able to see what was probably the truth coming from the front lines and other stuff. So, yeah, privacy and censorship, I feel like they go hand in hand. Without privacy, you can't speak your truth. You can't speak the truth in a tyrannical environment because you'll get shut up real quick.
Yeah, there's this social aspect to privacy, but if you take it back to Bitcoin and Litecoin, you have to understand that by design, the miners can pick which transactions they're going to include in a block.
Mm-hmm.
So filtering and blacklisting can actually work if there's enough coordination and there's not enough central decentralization of mining. So if in the absence of some sort of privacy, you can actually have these OFAC sanctioned addresses not being able to send coins. Now, I'm not advocating for some criminals being able to transact. I'm advocating for everyone being able to transact. And they already have the tooling to track, right?
Well, you were saying you were saying in your pod last week that if, for example, miners, you know, wanted to, they could block coins from Satoshi's addresses, right, from being spent. Because
that's a funny one. Yeah.
Because the theory is like if those coins ever were to move, it would cause the market to freak out and dump, right? Potentially.
It's much more than that because Bitcoin has been sold as this scarce asset, especially to bankers and these billionaires that Michael Saylor likes to present in his argumentation. So if this narrative of the selfless founder gets destroyed, I'm pretty sure that another narrative of the computer hacker who got access to Satoshi's coins is going to be presented. And then there's going to be an initiative to hard fork and restore to the previous state where Satoshi's coins were not moving. And maybe that is the real Satoshi moving his coins, but he cannot do that specifically because everyone is so greedy. And they say this guy never sold. The narrative is that he's never selling and he is this benevolent person who doesn't want to benefit from his own work. But I'm pretty sure that if Satoshi is around, he's smart enough to not engage or maybe spend coins from some of the older blocks that he mined in 2010 or something so that there's some deniability as there are more users.
Yeah, I felt like, you know, when, kind of backing up a little bit on the privacy thing and, you know, this, I guess, bowing to the institutions mentality, what's been weird is Bitcoin has all the monetary and social capital to really tell those institutions to F off. Like Monero has kind of embraced that. They're like, you know what? We don't need exchanges. It doesn't matter. There's, you know, people are going to find a way to use this because there's utility here. And I've been surprised how, I don't want to say they're afraid, but how compliant Bitcoiners have been in hopes of like these minor gains. You know, it's like, what are you winning here? You're personally going to enrich yourself by 20%, 50%, but you've got $3,000 into it. It's not like you're, this isn't winning the lottery, right? And oh, so you represent the whole class.
For many years, I've been to Bitcoin conferences and I did see that people like to spend with their credit cards because they say, you know, I don't want to be the next Laszlo guy to have my pizza moment. And right. They think that in the year of 2022 or 2023, they're going to have the same situation as someone had in 2010 when Bitcoin right. was worth just a few cents. And they think it's going to go up so much. It's going to absorb the entire monetary activity of the world. And all the world's money is going to get denominated into Bitcoin. And even one Satoshi is going to be worth more than $1. I think that's what they think is going to happen. But the question is how? If you don't scale and you don't have proper privacy, why would anyone want to use it? And as long as there's an alternative that does fulfill some use cases, why would anyone switch to Bitcoin just because they realize that they can have this monetary pump, they can get richer? Well, maybe they just need to spend it. So if you don't have this activity on Bitcoin, why would anyone want to save in it?
Kind of chicken and egg type of question, right?
Yeah, right.
It's a chicken and egg problem, I think, but you need to have both.
Do you think that's a possibility? Do you believe that you know, everything divided by 21 million is possible?
No, that's silly. Because even if you have a Bitcoin-only standard and a Bitcoin-only world, you can have governments issuing their own currencies on Bitcoin. So they're going to create tokens. There's already the infrastructure for that. There's Omni, there's Counterparty. They issue their own tokens and they say, you know, give me your one Bitcoin for these 10 bonds of mine. And I promise you that we're going to build this and or we're going to go to war. We're going to conquer our neighbor. And then I'm going to give you double.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way to put an end to the fiat situation because you can always print more money. Money is just the language that people use for transmitting value. And if there's someone in a position of authority giving you something in exchange for something that you have, there's always an endpoint. There's always a weak link that's going to legitimize this. And I don't think we're going to end wars and have all of this beautiful situation. Maybe we're going to make them more expensive. And maybe we're going to empower ourselves to have a stronger opinion on what the government is doing. So they're not going to be able to do whatever they want. They're going to have to ask us much mm-hmm. more often. But I don't see this as the revolution where we're going to live in citadels outside of the world and have this utopian society where everything magically works and deny the existence of human history and human nature and say, just because we have better money now, we're going to forget about all of the other human problems.
Yeah, well, I mean, the nature of money is to exchange it. So like when you, if you're exchanging money, you're acknowledging that something else has more value than the money you're holding. Like if I want to buy a house, I'm saying I value the house more than I value my money. So there's no way to say that the money will outstrip the value of, like, it doesn't make any sense at all. Like, there's utility. You have to have real use for the things that you consume. It's just, you can't, like, you know, you own a factory, your Bitcoin can't produce product for you. So you need to go find things that produce more value than the money you're holding in your wallet. And if you have a world where sitting on the money is going to produce more value, it just, it doesn't produce. I mean, I feel like the Peter Schiff when I say this, it doesn't make anything. It doesn't make anything real in the real world that people use and need in their daily lives. What it does produce is a free market of money, like a counter trade to the dollar. And it gives you utility of private transactions, right? Borderless transactions, this unusual governance model, going back to what you were talking about, Vlad. But yeah, to think that people are going to choose to just hold it instead of eating is insane.
I mean, I think if you look at, like, Argentina, right, you have this company that was in, or is in, a full-blown state of collapse, where they have, I want to say an opportunity, but I don't know if it's like an opportunity. They have the necessity to, like, uproot everything, every government department, and recreate it, right, with modern technology potentially. There's an opportunity to make things extremely efficient, right? To reduce the redundancies within the government, that are inherent to government, I guess, over time, ever growing estate. Because I think of, you know, I'm really into sci-fi, right? And if you look at Star Trek, they have they've evolved, or their society has progressed to a post-scarcity world, right? Where they don't have a want for anything. They have these matter compilers, these what are they called? Little microwaves, or able to create whatever they want out of them, food, toys. You know what I mean? They don't need the money, but they still pursue, I guess, they still have academic pursuits. They still want to explore space and whatnot. I think we are going to get there eventually. I think Bitcoin will help us get there. But I do believe that there will be a point where even Bitcoin won't be needed, where, like, keeping score is no longer going to be relevant. Maybe that's 50 years from now. Maybe it's 100 years from now. Maybe sooner. But, I mean, until then, I definitely think that Bitcoin and things like it are gonna play a role in making us, or they can play a role in making society, you know, different governments more efficient.
I think about this a lot, because you have two versions of the future. You're going to have a future where Bitcoin actually scales and becomes private and is the world's only form of money, which, once again, I doubt is ever going to happen, but it can be even bigger than gold. Or you have a future where you're going to have 21 million Bitcoins that get swapped for 100 million Moneros and 84 million Litecoins, and maybe 100 million Zcashes, and maybe some 100 million Ethers.
There's only, like, 19 million Monero, just so you know.
I don't know. I'm just saying. So maybe you're going to have that kind of future where you're going to have multiple networks with different benefits, and you get to swap in a way that's accessible for everyone between the networks so that you get the advantages that you want. You're not going to have everything divided by 21 million, but you're going to have everything divided by maybe 300 million. But that's still a net benefit. That's still disinflationary. That's still predictable. There's this distinction to be made between scarce and limited in supply. Because gold is scarce, but it's not limited in supply. You don't know how much of it there is, but you know that it's hard to find. So that's what gives it some value on markets.
Right.
And I think Bitcoin gives us a good way to measure it. But at the same time, I do see a movement of people trying to argue that there's no way this mining schedule situation is going to work in the way that Satoshi expected. And in 10 years, they think it's a good idea to turn on some sort of tail emission, because they don't believe users are willing to pay fees high enough to keep the miners going. And I do like the idea of these pegged sidechains. I do like Polestar's drive chains, because address the concerns directly with some trade-offs. But they do pay the miners, they do scale the network, and they do provide more functionality that can bring more developers and potentially more users. So I do like this.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's where it sounded like, you know, you were describing, right? Is that if you truly want scalability and you feel like 21 million is the most important number in the world, then your best option is something like Drive Chains, because at least you avoid any fractional reserve banking. You avoid custodians. I mean, we had Paul on a few weeks ago, and I'm overall supportive of it until somebody tells me some sort of, like, you know, gloom and doom that this is going to destroy Litecoin. I say it's important that we have as many users as possible able to use these things. You know, I've even gone on saying, like, if Litecoin blocks get full for an extended period of time and fees start to balloon, until we find a good alternative, block increases should be the answer in the short term, right? Maybe it's not the long-term answer, but I mean, I guess, what are you going on to Drive Chains? Do you feel this is if you can't even get Opcat added, do you feel like this is just impossible at this point? Have you lost faith in the development process of Bitcoin? That's maybe my short question.